This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
Hello from Stephen Crittenden. Welcome to the Religion Report. Today on the program, we're going green with a new animal ethics centre opening at Oxford University. We'll be speaking to its director about animal theology in a moment. But first to one area where Australia is actually leading the world on climate change. In what's believed to be a world first, 16 of Australia's leading faith communities released a document on global warming yesterday. Entitled Common Belief, it's a collection of theological and spiritual statements on the climate change debate. Those contributing include Indigenous Australians, Catholics and Orthodox, Baptists and Anglicans, Buddhists and Baha'is, the Australian Evangelical Alliance, the Uniting Church, the Salvation Army, Jews, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs and Lutherans. The Anglican Bishop of Canberra, Goulburn, George Browning, says we've exploited God's creation to breaking point and that concern for climate change is a core matter of faith for Christians. The Baptist Union of Australia makes public transport a moral issue and wants our leaders to take steps to reduce greenhouse emissions by 50% by 2050. The Evangelical Alliance quotes the Australian Business Roundtable, which suggests deep cuts to our emissions are needed in the order that would reduce our rate of economic growth by about 2% per annum. And they say we should be prepared to accept this. The Muslims want the government to do more to support alternative motor vehicle technology, hybrid and hydrogen-fueled cars. The conservative Australian Christian lobby is there, warning our political leaders that it will be pursuing climate change as an issue at the next federal election. Well, they all came together at the invitation of the Climate Institute of Australia, a lobby established in 2005 to raise public awareness about the issue. I spoke to some of the contributors to the project, beginning with the CEO of the Climate Institute, Corin Millais. Corin, how did this whole project come about? Who approached whom?
Well, the Climate Institute took the initiative to engage with the faith communities. We've been in a dialogue throughout this year, and we've been very encouraged with the response, as you've seen today. 16 faith communities calling for action on climate change, and puts the issue in the moral dimension without question.
Why did the Climate Institute want to add this extra moral, spiritual, theological dimension? Because that in itself is the interesting part of the story, it seems to me, that a secular group working with climate change should be reaching out to the various religious groups.
Well, certainly we have a policy and political focus in trying to change and make progressive action on climate change. That's the issue. And also it has been defined as a technocratic and scientific discipline. But I think that the wealth of information coming out about the human misery from climate change and the moral dilemmas about how the world comes together propel you towards the moral question. There's no question that you would think about this as a moral issue. I have children. I think about their future. It's not just about the price of coal or about whether we can't do anything. So it's absolutely important that such a large issue that is a great challenge is reflected in our own moral beliefs, whatever faith they are. When you're confronted by the nature of this kind of challenge, if you think that our actions are going to cause hundreds of millions of refugees, that burning fossil fuels in a profligate country like Australia has such impact on the world's poor, there is no question there is a moral dimension. And I think it's what you do reflects your values and your beliefs, whether you have the faith or not. And the 16 faiths have reflected their values on the issue. Above all, climate change is about what you believe is right for the world.
The Reverend Pravrayika Ajayaprana is a Hindu nun, and on behalf of the Hindu Council of Australia, she gave a speech of real grandeur at yesterday's launch. She said Hindu civilization was truly ancient, and that in civilizational terms, Australia was still a baby, but a child she'd seen beginning to grow up in her 20 years in this country.
As I came to Australia, I was astounded to see the bare land, bereft of trees. I was shocked because trees are our friends of humanity. What we give out, they take. What they give out, we take. That's how life has been intended on this earth. But we have been only taking what we wanted, not what we should have. And the result is devastation of trees, animals, everything. In India, we recycle everything. We don't waste anything at all. We don't have bins to be collected by the municipality. We recycle. Even the newspapers we read, we sell, and they are recycled by the shopkeepers, small shopkeepers, and they use it. So I would like Australia to stop wasting things, throwing things everywhere. When I see, go to the beach once in a way, which we do, and I see the cans and the papers and the wrappers thrown everywhere, I wonder why this so-called civilized country does not have a civic sense. India does not have much, I know. But here I didn't expect that. They should love the country and the place and their city much more.
As a Hindu speaking at this event on the issue of climate change, does it strike you that we often think of the various religious groups as being at each other's throats or disagreeing about things, but that the environment, when you hear all of the different representatives from the different religions speaking, the environment seems to be an area of genuine commonality?
That is true, because one of the greatest sayings in the most ancient literature of humankind, that is Rig Veda, is paths are many, but the goal is the same. Fundamentally, all the truths and ideals that all the faith representatives believe in are the same. Mother Earth is the basis for all of us. It's a common ground. And when we deal with Mother Earth, we cannot have diverse opinions.
One prominent idea in the statement by the Baha'i community is the idea of global citizenship. The National Secretary of the Baha'i community is John Walker.
Well, Stephen, as you can appreciate, the environmental problems facing humanity really can't be resolved without the recognition that we are all inhabitants of one planet. This is the central concept of the Baha'i faith, the oneness of humanity, and that the earth is but one country and mankind its citizens. And so we're all part of that, and we all have to cooperate in resolving and solving the problem of climate change.
The National Secretary of the Baha'i Community in Australia, John Walker. This week, the incoming president of the US Christian Coalition, the Reverend Joel Hunter, who was only appointed in October, resigned because his board of directors didn't agree with his plans to broaden the Christian Coalition's agenda to include issues like poverty, AIDS, and global warming. Meanwhile, in Australia, the managing director of the conservative Australian Christian Lobby, Jim Wallace, is happy to be part of the Coalition of Australian Religious Groups on Climate Change. That may seem surprising. Is it one of the real stories of this common belief document that he's even here?
Well, I don't think so, Stephen. Obviously, the Australian Christian Lobby is interested in trying to maintain and promote God's order in a whole range of issues, you know. And just as at the very moment, of course, we have this issue of a debate on cloning in the federal parliament, and we're interested there to make sure that God's purpose for creation, you know, is maintained by not cloning an individual, as we're now proposing to do. In the same way, we don't want to see the environment exploited and abused beyond what God intended, you know. We're meant to be stewards of the environment, and of course at the moment we're fast heading, as we've heard this morning, to a point where we're going to be the abusers of the environment for our own ends.
And has your arrival at this position involved some change or deepening of your thought on the environment? You know, I've suggested on the Religion Report this year that one of the big religion stories of 2006 is the embracing of the environment by Protestant groups in the United States, for example.
Yeah, certainly I think this issue of environmental change and particularly climate change, you know, has been highlighted to us all very much this year. I, like many, was sceptical of the figures that we've been given, pronouncements of the rate of change and its effect. But as we listen, as we did this morning, to Dr. Pearman talking, as he did, about the very definite indicators of change and the consequences of that, I don't think certainly churches, anybody interested in the fact that we're stewards of the environment, can sit back and not be part of a campaign to try to remedy these problems of climate change.
Very interesting to see you saying we at the Australian Christian Lobby are going to be watching at the next federal election to see which of the political parties is taking this issue seriously.
Well, that's right. I think very clearly now this is on the political agenda, and there's no doubt that we'll be asking parties and individual candidates to declare where they stand and what they would seek to do to try to remedy this problem. So there's no doubt at all that this will appear on the questions that are put to candidates and questions put to parties for the next federal election.
Jim Wallace of the Australian Christian Lobby. Down the other end of the Christian political spectrum is Dr. Brian Edgar of the Australian Evangelical Alliance. What does he think is the importance of a common statement like this one?
I think it's very important. We are, as a society, only now just becoming aware of the critical significance of climate change and the fact that it is a global issue that has to affect every individual on the face of the planet.
One thing that a number of religious leaders mentioned was the fact that this was an opportunity to be ecumenical, that the environment really is an area where the various religious groups genuinely find commonality. It's not made up, it's real.
Well, I think that's the case. If you look at the statements, they're obviously theologically different, but they are agreed on two things. One, about care for the environment, and secondly, the moral dimension of climate change. Even the Christian statements do differ somewhat among themselves. There's one approach that says, let's get on board in this in terms of it being a global issue, a human rights issue on which we make a common stand with everybody. Some of the other statements take a more biblical line and say it arises out of a particular theological and biblical framework.
The Baptists in particular.
Well, yes. So they mention the biblical framework, but almost all of the other statements implicitly mention the Bible. But there is this other dimension as well, that we are a part of a global community and it is a global responsibility, and both of them do go together.
We've heard that there hasn't been a statement really like this anywhere else, that this is a first. Do you think it's an indication that religion in Australia is actually right up the front on this issue compared with elsewhere, and that perhaps also various religious groups in Australia are paying close attention to what each other says?
Well, I think a lot of the credit has to go to the Climate Institute for drawing it together. I don't think it would have happened without them. So in one sense, it's a bit of a pity that you know, get a non-religious group who's drawing it together. But that is terrific. But then on the other hand, the responses have been really very good indeed. And I think it does say a lot for all of the religious groups in Australia that they have been prepared to, many of them have been prepared to come on board with this. And I think they have been watching what others have been saying.
They are of a uniformly high quality.
They are. They're remarkably. I've certainly been very carefully through all of the Christian ones. There really is a coherent theological consensus that we must care for the world, because it's based on the fact that God is creator and he made the world good, that he gave to humanity the responsibility to be stewards and care for it, and that doing something about climate change is also part of our responsibility of loving our neighbour. There is tremendous consensus on all of that, and therefore the action, the ethical action, flows out of that.
You all just sat a few moments ago listening to a brilliant, in fact, presentation from the CSIRO.
Pearman was terrific. It was really very good, succinct summary.
It is interesting, isn't it, that this isn't just about the various religions coming together, that there's a coalition with science. I mean, here you have all the religions together listening to a very scientific discourse.
Yes, that's right. And I think even Graham in his presentation there touched on some of the things that are important, because I think the scientists, like the various religious groups, are actually taking a broader view than many of those who have led the debate thus far in Australia, which has been based on economics and upon material growth, economic growth and development. And I think the scientists are recognising there are other issues, and that relates very much to what the churches and other religious groups are saying as well. There is more to life than simply growth. It's well-being, it's care for the environment, care for our neighbours. We should not be constrained in what we do by national boundaries. We have to look after the global community.
Music there by Philip Glass from the film Koyaanisqatsi. Koyaanisqatsi being the Hopi Indian word for life out of balance, or life that calls for another way of living. On ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and online, this is the Religion Report. Well, now to another first. Oxford University last week opened the first ever university-based Centre for Animal Ethics, the Ferrata Mora Centre, named after a famous Spanish philosopher who pioneered the campaign against bullfighting. As we'll hear, the centre has a very strong theological dimension. In fact, its first director, Professor Andrew Lindsay, is an Anglican minister. I asked him about the purpose of the Ferrata Mora Centre.
It's an international academy that aims to put animals on the intellectual agenda.
It's named after José Ferrata Mora, the Ferrata Mora Centre. José Ferrata Mora, the Spanish philosopher who campaigned against bullfighting. Tell us a bit about him.
Yes, well, he's a very impressive character. He was a Spanish intellectual, a very distinguished philosopher, who was almost the only intellectual voice against bullfighting in the 1930s. It's a courageous record, and we've named the centre after him.
Tell us about the religious or the theological focus of the centre, because it's not just animal rights and animal ethics. It's animal rights and animal ethics with a very strong theological basis.
Yes, we have over 100 advisors from over 10 countries, and interestingly enough, a high proportion, something like 40, I think, are theologians, which I think is a sign of a new kind of sensitivity, I'm pleased to say, amongst theologians to this issue, waking up to the idea that the world is God's creation and we ought to look after it.
Well, what is animal theology?
Animal theology is the attempt to see theology as if animals mattered. In the past, all our theology has been anthropocentric. It's been concerned with human beings and God's relationship with human beings and the salvation of human beings. Animals really haven't had a look in. And some of us think that if God is the creator of all things, it's really rather astonishing to think that God is only interested in one of the millions, if not billions, of species that she has made.
Right. It was always something that Pope John Paul II used to talk about, that human beings are the only creatures that God loves for themselves. And I never really understood what that meant. Always suspected that it was one of those theological gaps that get covered over quickly. What do you think about that?
Well, I'm chuckling because I'm afraid I rather agree. I think God didn't create us, as it were, for ourselves. God created us to look after the planet. That, after all, is the meaning of Genesis 2. Think of the creation saga. God creates the garden and the animals and the plants and then tells human beings to look after it, you see, to serve it and to till it, Genesis 2:11 and 17. In other words, I think the true interpretation of Genesis 2, at least, is not that we're the master species, but we should be the servant species, you see, to look after the world as God intended.
Well, I was going to ask you where your theology came from, given that, you know, apart from the odd donkey, animals don't have much of a role in, certainly not in the Gospels.
Oh, I'm sorry, I do think they have a very pivotal role in the Gospels, actually.
How's that?
The problem is that we've often, as it were, airbrushed them out of history. I mean, beginning of Mark, for example, Jesus spends time in the wilderness with the wild beasts.
And the implication of that being?
The implication of that being, actually, to be precisely theological, is that the Old Testament hope was always that the Messiah would usher in peace, not just for human beings, but for the whole of creation. That's why, for example, in Isaiah, we have the tremendous vision of the lion lying down with the lamb. And so when St. Mark, or whoever it was, penned St. Mark's Gospel and spoke about Jesus in the wilderness with the wild beasts, not controlling the wild beasts, not at war with them, but living with them, that was a way, I think, of expressing how the Messiah, Jesus was the Messiah because he brought peace to the whole of creation, even to wild beasts.
Andrew, do you believe that animals have souls?
Oh, I don't terribly care for the language of souls, but if you're asking me, do I think animals will go to heaven, the answer is most certainly yes. I think the place of animals in salvation is absolutely assured. What's much more difficult is whether human beings are going to be in heaven. And I say that, of course, because according to the biblical record, human beings are sinful, faithless, wicked, violent, even in a way that animals can't be. So I think the real question is whether human beings are going to be saved. And in that sense, I think the Bible is right to constantly put the focus on the salvation of human beings, because, of course, we can be so awful and wicked and faithless.
Now, where does this leave the issue of killing and eating animals?
Well, what it means, basically, I think, is this, that animals have nephesh, that is the Hebrew for God-given life, and we should respect that life wherever we can. Now, we live in a world that is deeply conflicted, and it means often that we can hardly live with other human beings without violence and strife. So I'm not pretending it's easy, but I would say that whenever we can, we should opt for non-violence. I think non-violence is always the Christian way whenever it's possible. Now, it may have been necessary for Jesus to have eaten fish in first century Palestine in order to live, but we know now, for example, that we don't have to eat meat in order to live or live well. So I would say when we have the freedom to do so, we ought to give animals the chance and opt to live non-violently.
But Andrew, when we kill a duck, say, to eat it, assuming it doesn't suffer, and we serve it up to an appreciative table of people with, you know, with a blood orange sauce, say, that's my favourite recipe, with some cinnamon and star anise, aren't we treating its life with the greatest possible respect, with honour even?
Well, that's a very peculiar kind of logic, if I may be so bold, Stephen. I mean, what will you be saying next? There are lots of turkeys hanging around at Christmas because they want to join in the festivities, because they want to complete their God-given life by being food for our stomach. Forgive me, Stephen, but I really do think we have to move from this anthropocentric, indeed gastrocentric, view of the universe. I don't think other living beings are simply here to be eaten. Now, I'm not an absolutist when it comes to killing. I think killing can be justified in self-defense and for euthanasia, both for humans and animals. But I do think killing requires justification. And I don't think it's enough to say, because something tastes good, that we have the right to kill it for food.
Yes, but doesn't that condemn you to remaining on the margins, if that's you?
On the margins? You mean a voice in the wilderness?
Yes.
You see, the voices in the wilderness, Stephen, have often been the people that were, who on reflection we've come to see weren't on the margins, but actually were calling us to the very centre of things. And sometimes, and this I think is the importance of the centre, sometimes I think in order to get to the heart of things, one has to pose the unusual or troubling or difficult questions.
Andrew, just this weekend, the Dutch Animal Rights Party won 2 seats in the Dutch Parliament in the elections there. According to its platform, it wants to end all animal suffering. I'm not sure whether that's any more achievable in the real world than ending all human suffering, but it is a very interesting political development, wouldn't you say?
I'm very pleased, obviously, about the situation in the Netherlands. Actually, I was in Amsterdam this year, and I met some of the people from the Party for the Animals working out of a single office, I should say, in Amsterdam.
Perhaps we should say too, Andrew, that this is the first two, the two members that have been elected to the parliament. This is the first time an animal rights party has ever been elected to a parliament in Europe.
Yes, well, it's especially good, you see, because I've always argued that animal people should use lawful, democratic, parliamentary methods, and now they are, and they're winning, and I think that's very good, don't you?
Finally, Andrew, we know there's a very high likelihood, if the worst global warming scenario comes to pass, that a huge percentage of the world's animals will be wiped out. Yet, and this is something I know you're very interested in, you say the animal rights movement and the green movement aren't really in coalition with each other. Should this be a green issue, and might such a policy focus help reposition the green movement more into the political mainstream?
Well, that's a very interesting issue. I mean, the problem historically with green attitudes is they tend to see the whole, as it were, and they don't see individuals within it, so they're more concerned about saving the whole than saving the individuals in it. But global warming is a classic example of where the two issues come, I think, most powerfully together. We need to help the individuals, but unless we save the whole, there won't be a place, much of a place, for humans or animals.
How much is global warming likely to be a focus of your centre's work in the coming years?
Well, no one, I think, can now think ethically without taking into account the whole survival of the planet, because, quite frankly, greedy, selfish human beings are behaved in such a way that they're now not just threatening the nest, but threatening themselves, the future of their own species. And, you see, one of the reasons I don't react well to your previous notion that we can't reduce animal suffering is because we need a completely new paradigm in our way of thinking, you see. In the same way we've regarded animals as simply things, tools, machines, so we've simply regarded the Earth really as a kind of dustbin that we can use and abuse as we wish.
Surely, I'm not suggesting we can't reduce animal suffering. I'm suggesting that the idea we can end it may be a pipe dream.
Well, I'm also in favour of child rights, and I look forward to the day when cruelty to children is a thing of the past. I think it's very difficult to justify the infliction of suffering on those that are, you know, weaker, more vulnerable, those that can't represent themselves. It seems to me the case of children and the case of animals have a strong intellectual underpinning, which is that the powerful and the strong ought to look after the vulnerable and the weak.
Let's go back to the Dutch Party for the Animals. In their policy platform before this election, they talked about the fact that animals have emotions and have consciences, and that we should leave them to live according to their own nature. Now, I might get you to comment on the question of consciences. My cat certainly has emotions. I'm not sure if she has a conscience. If she did, she wouldn't shit under the piano all the time. Is that perhaps a 19th century romantic view of animals, that they should be allowed to live according to their own nature?
Well, it's strange you should mention that, actually, because when I read the website too and I saw the word consciences too, I rather balked at the use of that term, and I couldn't help thinking it was based on a mistranslation. What I think they really meant is they have their own consciousness or self-consciousness. I believe human beings alone are pretty unique, actually, in having a moral sense. I don't think animals are moral agents in the sense of being morally responsible and having free will and so on. However, on the larger question of whether we should respect animals to live their own God-given life, I'm all in favour of that, aren't you? I mean, look again at Genesis. I mean, God doesn't say, look, human beings, it's all for you, you can do what you like. On the contrary, God, you know, according to the poetic saga of Genesis, gives every living creature its own space and blesses it and allows it to be. Well,
Andrew, I'd like to be able to live according to my own nature as well. It's just that I don't really know what that is.
Yes, well, the problem is we're still in search of our nature, and I don't think we found it yet. I mean, people often say to me, ah, but aren't human beings superior? And I say, oh, I desperately want to believe that. I desperately want to believe that as a matter of faith. The problem is I can't see much evidence of it.
Thank you very much for being on the Religion Report.
Delighted. Thank you, Stephen.
Professor Andrew Lindsay of Oxford University. And I think you'll find the recipe for duck in Kylie Kwong. Well, that's all from us. Thanks to Noel Debye and Jenny Parsonage. I'm Stephen Crittenden. See you next week.
ABC Radio National. more than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.